are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio. My name is Keith, amateur radio operator W0NX. The following articles are from the January 2024 The Spectrum Monitor, and we'll begin by finishing the remainder of Amateur Radio Insights by Kirk Kleinschmidt, NT0Z, Rotator Roulette. If you need something larger, if it's not a rebuilt tail twister, you're pretty much on your own. If you can afford a big beam, you can probably afford expensive rotators and even a few expensive mistakes, so go get them. Experts recommend loading your rotator to 80% of its maximum capacity, max, to build in a reasonable safety margin. So, if your rotator is rated for 10 square feet, limit your antenna to 8 square feet to ensure a long and healthy service life. If, after a nasty winter storm, you find your antenna covered by a thick coating of ice, don't touch the rotator control box until the ice has completely melted, or you may destroy your rotator, antenna, and even your tower. The extra weight of the ice may far exceed specs, and if you don't try to move the antenna until all of the excess weight has melted away, you're way more likely to get lucky. When installing your rotator, be sure to use control wires of the specified size or larger, or your rotator's motor may not work, may work slowly, or may fail prematurely. You may be able to get away with just about any size of wire for the signal and position indicator wires, but the drive motor wires must be sufficiently beefy. Read the manual carefully. I am happily using thermostat cable to connect my rotator to my control box over a 105-foot run. The important thing is to meet or exceed the manufacturer's wire size ratings, which depend on run lengths to make the connections. You don't have to buy actual rotator cable, which usually has two beefy motor wires and a bunch of smaller signal wires bundled inside a sexy, expensive jacket. For example, ops who need to span several hundred feet between rotator and control box often use 10-gauge house wiring for the drive motor wires and 18-gauge house wiring for the signal wires. As long as it's suitably sized and protected from UV and moisture, rotator wire is rotator wire. For shorter runs, twisting multiple strands together from the same multi-wire cable works just fine. Common Cat5 LAN cable, for example, is 8 strands of 24-gauge insulated wire. The 24-gauge wires may work just fine for the signal wires, but multiple wires will have to be paralleled to beef them up enough to handle the drive motor. This isn't a big deal, as 4 24-gauge wires in parallel are the equivalent of 1 18-gauge wire. See various online calculators to explore this further. To power my big T2X rotator, I'd need to connect the 8 strands in one length of Cat5 to make 2 4-wire strands, which is equivalent to 2 strands of 18-gauge wire to power the motor. A second length of Cat5 would provide up to 8 signal sensor wires. You can buy 1,000-foot spools of Cat5 on Craigslist for $20. One box is a lifetime supply of rotator cable, plus a lifetime supply of hookup wire for home brewing circuits and projects. Not all Cat5 jackets will live forever when exposed to UV, but I have had runs remain intact for 8 to 10 years when strung on a pilot wire between the house and the garage. Your mileage may vary, but considering the low cost and easy availability, plus the fact that you might have a few thousand feet on hand, Cat5 rotator cables might be just fine. I was about to do this in 2019 when I found the spool of Southwire 18-8 UV-rated thermostat wire. And if I were doing this project today, I'd actually use a couple runs of Cat 5. Why? Because I have a near-infinite supply already on hand. And because the price of the 250-foot spool of 18-8 thermostat wire went from $65 then to $125 today. For a reality check, real 8-strand rotator cable, probably with a longer-lasting outer jacket, costs about $3 a foot, making a 250-foot spool about $750. Ouch! If you're installing a spendy beam on a remote mountaintop, go for it. Otherwise, before climbing to the top of your tower, connect your rotator to your control box to test them. If possible, purchase your rotator from a vendor that will test it prior to shipping. If you can, mount your rotator at ground level instead of up high. This requires a rotating mast, but calibrating, repairing, or replacing a low-down rotator is much easier than the traditional alternative. Buying the right antenna rotator isn't always easy and is rarely inexpensive. In general, rotators cost too much, aren't as rugged as they could and should be, and don't take advantage of superior mechanical and electronic design elements, many of which have been perfected for decades. Worm gears instead of planetary gears, solid-state positioning sensors instead of potentiometers, etc. Remember, the single best way to ensure long-term rotator success is to buy more rotator than you need. My modest NA4RR hexagonal beam holds my T2X rotator to only 20% of its rated capacity, and that's just fine by me. And now a feature article, The Many Consequences of QRP, by Corey G.B. Sickles, WA3UVV. It is difficult for me to believe, but half a century ago, I became a ham. At that time, CB radio was something of a gateway drug into amateur radio. It gave many a taste of what personal, two-way radio communications could be like. For those who did move up to amateur radio, it was also our first taste of QRP, as CB was limited to no more than 5 watts of power. The term comes from the standard amateur radio Q codes, where QRP means, I am lowering my power. And QRP question mark means, shall I lower my power? Its polar opposite is QRO, meaning, I am increasing my power. And QRO question mark means, shall I increase my power? In common use, QRO refers to power levels higher than the standard 100-watt output of most modern HF transceivers. Although QRP at one time referred to power levels under 100 watts, it has equated to a power level of 5 watts or less for all of the time I have been a ham. My entry into ham radio was through the Novice Class license. The privileges of this license at that time limited you to CW-only operation on small subbands of the 80-meter, 40-meter, 15-meter, and 10-meter HF bands. Your transmitting frequency had to be crystal controlled, and your transmitter input power had to be no more than 75 watts. This typically equated to about 38 watts output, given the vacuum tube technology of the day. Like many new hams, I was building my own transmitter, which was supposed to reward me with 60 watts in or 30 watts out. Major components, transformers, chokes, rectifier and output tubes, passives, etc., for this project were harvested from a pair of television chassis from a nearby repair shop owned by a ham. As I was picking up some additional components for this project from one of the electronic parts stores in town, I was discussing my objective with a counterman working there who was also a ham. while mentioning my desire for more power once I eventually upgraded to a general class license, he offered that I did not actually need as much power as I was planning on, and could make plenty of contacts with a single tube transmitter and less than 10 watts. He also mentioned that it would be a faster path to getting on the air with less of a cash outlay. Those two benefits were of particular interest, as I was impatient and was already stretching my allowance and ability to earn money with odd jobs while still in high school. Still, I was incredibly skeptical and convinced that any time and money expended toward this pursuit would be a total waste. On a sheet of paper, he sketched out a schematic from memory. The tube he selected was a 6V6, a little brother in the popular 6L6 series. The parts list that resulted was a bit more than the extra cash I had on me. After some discussion, a slightly different design, using a 117N7 tube, was arrived at. This tube was used in many portable record players and offered a mere 3 watts, but did not need a power transformer, as it had a filament designed for the North American power grid. In addition, most of the passive components needed were already in my expanding junk box. Instead of a nice cabinet, it would be assembled on a scrap piece of wood, with nails as connection points and a coil wound on a leftover plastic pill bottle. As it was transformerless, it connected directly into the mains. As all the wiring was exposed, it was incredibly dangerous, and I do not suggest that anyone today build such a thing, especially without an isolation transformer in use. It is all too easy to plug something like this into an outlet backwards and end up with a hot ground. I finally did go ahead and buy what I needed, perhaps compelled by a strong desire to be able to say, "I told you it would not work." After dinner that evening, I invested the time to collect the needed parts, hammered in nails according to the layout, soldered in the components, and mustered up enough conviction to plug it in. No smoke. Voltage is good. Time to try it out. I put in a 40-meter crystal and called CQ. 3 long minutes of this went by, as I became increasingly convinced that I should have been working on my 60-watt rig. I switched back to receive and heard a ham returning my call. It was soon revealed that my signal, my measly less than 2 watts to the antenna signal, could be heard in Oregon. After an enjoyable and surprising QSO, I had a handful of other contacts, then called it a night. I was forever hooked on QRP. In sharp contrast to the popular HF rigs of 1973, any solid-state HF transceiver currently manufactured can have its output power dialed down to 5 watts or less. With a 100-watt rig, you can experiment with lower powers and see if the thrill of getting the most out of a watt is something that brings you joy. Lower power transmitters are generally simpler in nature. Enjoying the use of something you have built fits well into some of the themes of amateur radio, encouraging made-from-scratch, kit-building, or general home-brewing activities. This is usually one of the first consequences from the joy of QRP. Many of us bemoan the corporate death of the Heath Company in two-tone green radios, but there are many contemporary producers of good quality kits offered at very reasonable prices. One of the first that comes to mind is HF Signals and their Ubidex Multimode HF Unkit concept. Purchase one of these and you get rewarded with a set of populated PC boards as the radio and display and control panel. The package includes all of the controls you will need to assemble a 10 or 20 watts output, very nicely featured HF rig that supports voice, data, and CW. Various cases and options are also available, yet the costs of the basic platform can be well under $200. Maybe you would just like to build something simple, perhaps in the way of a single-band CW transmitter. The four-state QRP Club offers a variety of kits. Possibly the best known is the Nunn Simpler NS40, which has about 30 through-hole components and a postcard-sized PC board with the needed coils bound into a copper layer. No coils to wind, and as we live in modern times, the one tube of my open-board transmitter in the past gives way to a single transistor running in E-class operation. With 13.8 volts supplied to the board, you should experience an output of 8 watts. At a lower voltage, you can be well into official QRP territory. The first iteration of this board was designed for use on the 40-meter band. A subsequent model is tuned for the 80-meter band. I am patiently waiting for 20-meter and 30-meter flavors as well. Hopefully, they will become a reality soon. In the meantime, there is the 4S QRP Cricket Series transceiver. These have been designed for our 7 MHz, 10 MHz, and 14 MHz bands, offering about 3/4 watts out, with a better-than-you-would-expect receiver, powered from a single 9-volt battery. The kit even has a PC board-based straight key that you can use. Either of these kits is about $40 each and requires a mere hour of your time to build. Much like my 117N7-based transmitter, but eminently less dangerous, you can build it in an hour and then immediately get on the air. With less than a watt, known as QRPP power levels, I have used my crickets to work several states at notable distances. Other kits can be found from QRP Kits, QRP Guys, QRP Me, and more. I believe you will be surprised at the quality and final product. Plus, you will have the satisfaction of being on the air with something you built. Yes, knowledge of CW is a requirement with such radios, but CW is easy to learn and a skill that is rewarding on its own. When I learned CW, I learned it using a more difficult method than necessary. First, I learned it at 5 words per minute. Later, I had to learn the sound of the characters again at 13 words per minute. At each tier, I was essentially hearing the characters with a different sound each time. Today, the best method has you learning the sound of each character at your desired target speed, perhaps 25 words per minute, 40 words per minute, or 50-plus words per minute. The effective rate at which you learn is determined by the interstitial pause between each character. Stretched out, this can result in an effective speed of 5 words per minute, then 10 words per minute, then 15 words per minute, and so on. All that changes is the time in between the same sounding characters, but not the sound of the characters. As it gets shorter and shorter, you soon arrive at your target speed. Then, you can start to read CW in the same way as you are reading this article. You read the pattern for the altogether. Not so much the letters T-H-E, but the complete word. Commonly used words such as the, this, is, are, my, QTH, rig, name, and many others can be learned and memorized. Once done, you can stop writing down each letter or word during a conversation. Specifics like call sign, individual's name, location, radio being used, RST, and so on, are really all you need to jot down. That takes a lot of stress out of CW and transforms the whole QSO into a much more pleasurable experience. Groups like CW Ops can help you get there with the online classes and on-air practice sessions. Once you have learned CW, two more QRP consequences come into view: DX chasing and contests. In many countries, you will find more hams using CW than voice. If you want to work them and get them in the log, then CW may well be the best way to go. For lower power or even higher power with poor band conditions, CW has a nice punch factor that gets signals through. In multi-mode contests, CW contacts typically have a higher point value. A good operator, just like the one you can become, can tap out CW contacts in the same time as most voice contacts require. Even with a mere 2-to-1 points ratio, the differences add up fast. If you enjoy competition, there are also enough CW-only contests to keep you busy throughout the year. From my experience, CWDX and contest pile-ups seem to be handled in a more, dare I say, polite approach than with the voice equivalents. Also, if you like to be on the air when people in your home are sleeping and you have a voice that carries, CW has another advantage with headphones in place. There will be no audible sound for others to hear. Low power into a highly efficient antenna system can outperform high power into a poorly functioning antenna system. This brings us to another consequence of low power appreciation: antennas, tuners, and feed lines, the components of an antenna system. Over the years, I have seen stations with amplifiers in use, along with some of the worst quality coaxial cables. Good cable with low loss and 100% shielding does cost more than some RG58 that you got a great deal on at a hamfest. But you are not doing yourself, your transceiver, or your amplifier any favors. I have seen bargain cable that only provides 70% shielding. As ridiculous as that may sound, such cable, RG8, too, does exist and is in use more than you might expect. Good low-loss cable will reward you every day with more signal to your antenna for more to hear you. It will also allow more signal to reach your receiver's front end so that you can hear others that much better. For most barefoot stations, not just QRP, good quality RG8X, such as Times Microwave's LMR240, is all you need for HF operation, unless you are pushing the limits of the QRO envelope. An antenna is going to be resonant at a given frequency and usable over a limited range above and below that frequency. To compensate for such impedance and voltage standing wave ratio, VSWR, differences, we have matching devices known as antenna tuners. A low insertion loss tuner, automatic or manual, is invaluable for compensating for the mismatches and related losses. As coaxial cable becomes more and more lossy the further away from the desired impedance the antenna system may become, it is best to place the matching network at the feed point of the antenna rather than the back of the transceiver. This is important at any power level, but more significant when dealing with single-digit watts. If you are using balanced feed line, then the considerations are a bit different. For such reasons, a remote tuner is better. I like the convenience and speed of an automatic tuner, but I also know that I can fine-tune a manual tuner for an even better match than what the typical algorithms of an automatic tuner's microcontroller is set to meet a best match set of parameters. Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio. My name is Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.